tune out of the anti-white system
and tune into the pro-white system on RadioAryan.com.
Alright, ladies and gentlemen, this is Ted Midward, this is Caucasian Christian Communications. We are moving on to part 10 of our continuing series on Henry Ford's The International Jew. Okay, part 10 is entitled, How the Jewish Question Touches the Farm. The real estate speculations of the Jews are familiar to all, but unfortunately do not constitute their entire land program. Many American cities have changed their characters entirely during the past 15 years by reason of Jewish speculation in residence property, and it is a fact established in the larger eastern cities that the recent exorbitant and extortionate rise in rents was largely a matter of the Jewish landlord. Governor of one of the most important of our commonwealths was loath to sign a bill regulating rents. His hesitancy was encouraged by very heavy pressure brought to bear upon him by the weightiest Jewish financial interests in his own and neighboring states. He finally decided that he would sign the bill and give the law effect. And the fact that decided him was his personal investigation and the investigation of his personal agents into hundreds of cases of abuse, where he discovered that it was a common practice among Jewish landlords to transfer the same piece of property round and round to every member of the family in turn, each transfer being the excuse for a new increase in the rent. Men have opened their eyes to the Jewish question in various ways. This was the way a governor had his eyes opened. That, however, is not the peculiarity of Jewish landlords alone. Gentile landlords have played the same trick. But landlordism is a peculiarly Jewish ambition and distinction. The Jew is the landlord of America. Any group of tenants almost anywhere in America, except the West, could testify to this. Nor is landlordism itself reprehensible. Things being what they are, unless it is antisocial and anti-American. And just here is where it gets point. Some of the oldest and most sacred shrines of Americanism in the East have entirely lost their character as such by the invasion, not of foreigners, but of Jews. The more one sees of the invasion, the more one utterly distrusts the statistics given out by Jews as to the Jewish population of the United States. Do you know that one nationality on which the government of the United States is stopped from asking questions, either for immigration or census statistics, is the Jewish? Do you know that when the government of the United States wants to know anything about the Jews, it must go to statisticians, which the Jews themselves support? If a nation claims that it is no nation with respect to the United States government, as the Jews claim, and has no national statistics which it will permit to government to collect in the official way, why should it treat itself as a nation and keep its own record? The Jews of the United States, like the Jews of every European country, are a nation among themselves, with their own government, their own policy, their own records. And the United States government does business with the Jewish government in America through chosen Jews. No doubt about that. It is, however, a digression. The matter of Jewish statistics will come up again. In the meantime, a glance at the rapid changing of so many American cities in all parts of the land leads to the belief that the Jewish statistics furnished by the Jews for Gentile consumption entirely misstate the facts, and this belief is strengthened by the knowledge that the statistics given by the Jews for Jewish consumption are very different from those supplied for the outside world. Landlordism may be explained by the inclination of the Jew towards speculation, and we know that real estate has been made one of the most speculative of occupations, disgracefully, almost disastrously so. The Jew cannot be condemned for becoming a landlord, for becoming the most conspicuous landlord in America. He cannot be condemned, apart from his Gentile co-offenders, for the abuse he has made of his advantage as landlord. But it is a matter for American concern that the cities to which, in the school books, our children are taught to look as the birthplaces of liberty, and as still the spokesmen of Americanism, should become Semite cities, financially and politically, and the recruiting grounds of the world's Bolshevism. Until recently, however, the Jew in America has not cared for the land. It is a characteristic. The Jew is not an agriculturalist. Lavish fortunes have been expended to make him so, but the productive work of farming has not had, and does not now have, any appeal to him. His choice in land is this: land that produces gold from the mine, and land that produces rents. Land that produces mere potatoes and wheat has not directly interested him. It is true, of course, that the land question has been distinctly Jewish in countries like Poland and Romania. No law against Jews owning land in those countries has ever been effective in preventing their control of whole provinces. Not that the Jews demanded the right to farm the land. Their choice was to farm the farmers. By devious methods and the use of Gentile fronts, they could always secure control of the land, and thus, dominating the peasants, they could create almost any condition they wished. That is what they actually did. That is the Jewish question in those parts of the world. Not for farming purposes, it must be understood, but for the purpose of controlling the main source of wealth in agricultural countries, and for taking the control of people away from their natural Gentile leaders. These two things always go together in countries where there is intellectual or landed aristocracy to which the people look for leadership. The Jewish program is to destroy that leadership by gaining control of the land. It is profitable, of course, but when you survey the outworking of the plan, you always see something other than profits involved. The consummate perfection of the Jewish plan for world control is that it does not involve sacrifice, as have other plans. It is immensely profitable at every stage, and the greater the profitableness, the more surely the purpose is being achieved. In America, there was no aristocracy to be cut under by the gaining of land control. Jewish activity in the United States, until recently, has confined itself to the control of land products after they have been produced. That is, so to say, Jewish interests do not engage in trapping, but they control the fur trade. Speaking of furs, it is very funny to see how some affairs turn out. During the war, there was a great to-do made about the German control of the American fur trade. It was true that the fur trade was controlled from Germany, but not by Germans, by Jews. And then a great to-do was made about seizing, confiscating, and absolutely selling out that German fur business to Americans, and the Americans who bought it were Jews. The actual control has never changed. Profits still find their way to the international purse. But furs is just an example. Jewish interests do not engage in raising grain, but control the grain that others produce. The need of the United States is a who's who of Jewish financiers. People may identify the men about whom they read as having made this corner or sprung that coup. These interests, which have simply grabbed American-produced wealth and made American consumers pay and pay and pay, have been able to operate almost openly because of the sheer blindness of the American people as they read their newspapers. And, of course, while the American newspaper will gladly inform you that this man is an Italian, that man is a Pole, and the other man is a Briton, it will never tell you that the fourth man is a Jew. There's a Jewish organization in every city, large and small, to prevent it. And they prevent it by methods that are violent and wholly subversive to the American ideal of liberty. So, until recently, the plan in the United States has been to seize the commodity at just that point in its passage from the producer to the consumer where the heaviest weight of profit can be extracted from it, at the neck of a bottle, so to speak, and to control it there. It is not service that the people pay for. They pay for seizure. But a new movement has begun in the United States. Jewish millions are now being used to secure immense tracts of American lands. Formerly, it was enough to control the cotton, as the bread was controlled, but now the movement is toward controlling the cotton lands. The operations are carefully guarded. Gentile fronts are used almost exclusively. Follow the trail through all the blinds and all the false agents, and you come at last to the International Jew, whose throne is set up in London. Many Jews have written the Dearborn Independent saying that they do not know about these racial plans for world control. It may well be believed that they do not. One purpose of these articles is to tell them about it. But this, every Jew rejoices in, the movement of his people toward power, and it is this sentiment that the International Jew implicitly trusts, and because this sentiment exists in the international program, secures a maximum of success at a minimum risk of exposure. Jewry is not a democracy, but an autocracy. Of course, the ordinary Jew does not know. The question is, why should he revile the Gentile who tries to tell him? If a Jew will not seal his mind against the statements made in these articles, he will find in his own knowledge sufficient corroboration of their principal features. He will be in a better position to assist in the solution of the Jewish question. It is with amazement at certain men's conception of editorial honesty that the Dearborn Independent has read some of the reports made of these articles. Undercover, principally of the Yiddish, alleged translations of these articles have been flung broadcast among non-English-speaking Jews, translations which not only bear no resemblance to the original, but actually insert whole paragraphs of matter which never appeared in the original at all. Is there a fear of permitting the average Jew to read this series? Nothing is more desired by those whose purpose is to lay foundations for the solution of the Jewish question in America than that every Jew in the United States should know exactly what is being printed here week by week. The Jew has been deceived by his leaders long enough. The fact is, then, that there is a definite and already well-forwarded movement toward the control of the cotton lands of the United States. First step was to depreciate the market value of these lands as much as possible. Pressure was brought through certain banks to limit the cotton farmers' efforts. They were told that if they planted more acreage to cotton than they were told to, they would not be financed. Cotton production was to go down while cotton prices were to go up, and the profits were not the farmers, but those who controlled the course of cotton from the first market to the wearer. Cotton farming was made to be less than profitable, while cotton speculation was to become very profitable. The public was being compelled to supply the money by which Jewish controllers were to buy the land. In brief, it was to be made more profitable to sell cotton lands than to sell cotton. These statements are being deliberately restricted to the traffic in cotton lands. Jewish financiers in New York and London know these things, even if Jewish editors and rabbis do not. This movement has been within the knowledge of certain classes of businessmen for a long time. Indeed, some have been forced by what used to be called the pressure of circumstances to serve the movement, but they were not able to interpret its meaning. It's only recently that the more important Gentile businessmen of the United States have been able to interpret certain things. The war was a potent eye-opener. Those wonderful documents, known as the Protocols, with their strong grasp of every element of life, have not overlooked land. The land program, found in the Sixth Protocol, which is one of the briefest of these documents and may be quoted in full to show now the relation it bears to certain excerpts made in previous articles. Here we go, Protocol 6. We shall soon begin to establish huge monopolies, colossal reservoirs of wealth, upon which even the big Gentile properties will be dependent to such an extent that they will all fall together with the government credit on the day following the potential catastrophe. The economists here present must carefully weigh the significance of this combination. We must develop by every means the importance of our super-government, representing it as the protector and benefactor of all who voluntarily submit to us. The aristocracy of the Gentiles as a political force has passed away. We need not take them into consideration. But, as owners of the land, they are harmful to us in that they are independent in their sources of livelihood. Therefore, at all costs, we must deprive them of their land. Are you listening out there? The best means to attain this is to increase the taxes and mortgage indebtedness. These measures will keep land ownership in a state of unconditional subordination. Unable to satisfy their needs by small inheritances, the aristocrats among the Gentiles will burn themselves out rapidly. At the same time, it is necessary to encourage trade and industry vigorously, and especially speculation, the function of which is to act as a counterpoise to industry. Without speculation, industry will cause private capital to increase and tend to improve the condition of agriculture by freeing the land from indebtedness for loans by the land banks. It is necessary for industry to deplete the land both of laborers and capital and, through speculations, transfer all the money of the world into our hands, thereby throwing the Gentiles into the ranks of the proletariat. The Gentiles will then bow before us to obtain the right to existence. To destroy Gentile industry, we shall, as an incentive to this speculation, encourage among the Gentiles a strong demand for luxuries, all enticing luxuries. We will force up wages, which, however, will be of no benefit to the workers, for we will at the same time cause a rise in the prices of prime necessities, pretending that this is due to the decline of agriculture and of cattle raising. We will also artfully and deeply undermine the sources of production by instilling in the workmen ideas of anarchy and encourage them in the use of alcohol, at the same time taking measures to drive all the intellectual forces of the Gentiles from the land. That the true situation shall not be noticed by the Gentiles prematurely, we will mask it by a pretended effort to serve the working classes and promote great economic principles, for which an active propaganda will be carried on through our economic theories. The local and passing element in this is the aristocracy of the Gentiles. That is to say, the program is not entirely fulfilled by the passing of aristocrats. Jewry goes on just the same. Its program stretches far. Jewry will retain such kings as it desires as long as it desires them. Probably the last throne to be vacated will be the British throne, because what to the British mind is the honor of being Jewry's protector, and therefore the inheritor of the blessing that attitude brings, is to the Jewish mind the good fortune of being able to use a worldwide empire for the furtherance of Jewry's purpose. Each has served the other, and the partnership will probably last until Jewry gets ready to throw Britain over, which Jewry can do at almost any time. There are indications that it has already started in this last task. But the permanent elements in the protocol are the land, the Jews, and the Gentiles. A word of explanation may be necessary on this inclusion of the Gentiles as permanent. Protocols do not contemplate the extermination of the Gentiles, nor the making of this world a completely Jewish populated world. The protocols contemplate a Gentile world ruled by the Jews as masters, the Gentiles as hewers of wood and drawers of water, a policy which every Old Testament reader knows to be typically Jewish, and the source of divine judgment upon Israel time and again. Now, look at this whole program as it concerns the land. Here's an excerpt from the protocols. Owners of the land are harmful to us in that they are independent in their sources of livelihood. That is a foundation principle of the protocols. It matters not whether the owners are the Gentile aristocracy, the peasants of Poland, or the farmers of the United States. Land ownership makes the owners independent in their sources of livelihood, and any form of independence is fatal to the success of the world program, which is written so comprehensively in the protocols and which is advancing so comprehensively under Jewish guidance in the world of actual affairs today. Not tillers of the land, not dwellers of the land, not tenants, not an agricultural peasantry, but owners of the land. This is the class singled out for attention in this sixth protocol because they are independent in their sources of livelihood. Now, there has been no time in history of the United States when apparently it was more easy for the farmer to own his land than now. Mortgages should be a thing of the past. Everywhere the propaganda of the question tells us that the farmers are growing rich. And yet, there were never so many abandoned farms. Therefore, at all costs, as the protocol says, we must deprive them of their land. How? The best means to attain this is to increase land taxes and mortgage indebtedness. high taxes to keep the land at all, borrowed money to finance the tilling of it. These measures will keep land ownership in a state of unconditional subordination. We will leave it to the farmers of the United States to say whether this is working or not. And in a future reference to this subject, we will show that whenever an attempt is made to enable farmers to borrow money at decent rates, whenever it is proposed to lighten the burden of mortgage indebtedness on the farm, Jewish financial influence in the United States steps in to prevent it, or, failing to prevent it, mess it all up in the operation. By increasing the farmer's financial disability on the one hand, and by increasing industrial allurements on the other, a very great deal is accomplished. The protocol says, it is necessary for industry to deplete the land both of laborers and capital. Has that been done? Have the farms of the United States been depleted both of laborers and capital? Certainly. Money is harder for the farmer to get than it is for any other man, and as for labor, he cannot get it on any terms. What is the result of these two influences, the one working on the farm and the other in the cities? It is precisely what the protocol says it will be, increased wages that buy less of the materials of life. Remember the excerpt? We will at the same time cause a rise in prices of prime necessities, pretending that this is due to the decline of agriculture and cattle raising. The Jew who set these protocols in order was a financier, economist, and philosopher of the First Order. He knew what he was talking about. His operations in the ordinary world of business always indicated that he knew exactly what he was doing. How well this sixth protocol has worked, and is still working out in human affairs, is before the eyes of everyone to see. Here in the United States, one of the most important movements toward real independence of the financial powers has been begun by the farmers. The farmer's strong advantage is that, owning the land, he is independent in his sources of livelihood. The land will feed him, whether he pleases international Jewish financiers or not. His position is impregnable as long as the sun shines and the seasons roll. It was therefore necessary to do something to hinder this budding independence. He was placed under a greater disadvantage than any other businessman in borrowing capital. He was placed more ruthlessly than any other producer between the upper and nether stones of a thievish distribution system. Labor was drawn away from the farm. The Jew-controlled melodrama made the farmer a rube, and Jew-made fiction presented him as a hick, causing his sons to be ashamed of farm life. The grain syndicates which operate against the farmer are Jew-controlled. There is no longer any possibility of doubting, when the facts of actual affairs are put alongside the written program, that the farmer of the United States has an interest in this question. What would this world program gain if the wage workers were enslaved and the farmers were allowed to go scot-free? Therefore, the program of agricultural interference, which has been only partially outlined here. But this is not all. Any writer who attempts to fully inform the Gentile mind on the Jewish question must often feel that the extent of the protocol's conspiracy is so great as to stagger the Gentile mind. Gentiles are not conspirators. They cannot follow a clue through long and devious and darkened channels. The elaborate completeness of the Jewish program, the perfect coordination of its massive details, wearies the Gentile mind. This, really more than the daring of the program itself, constitutes the principal danger of the program being fulfilled. Gentile mental laziness is the most powerful ally the world program has. Boy, is that true. For example, after citing the perfectly obvious coincidence and most probable connection between the protocols and the observable facts with reference to the farm situation, the writer is compelled to say, as above, but this is not all, and it is a peculiarity of Gentile psychology that the Gentile reader will feel that it ought to be all because it is so complete. This is where the Jewish mind outmaneuvers the Gentile mind. Gentiles may do a thing for one reason. The Jew often does the same thing for three or four reasons. the Gentile can understand thus far why Jewish financiers seek control of the land in order to prevent widespread agricultural independence, which, as the Sixth Protocol says, would be harmful to us. That reason is perfectly clear. But there is another. It is found in the 12th Protocol. It contemplates nothing less than the playing of city against country in the great game now being exposed. Complete control over the city by the industrial leverage and over the country by the debt leverage will enable the hidden players to move first the country by saying that the city demands certain things, and then move the city by saying that the country demands certain things, thus splitting the citizens and farmers apart, using them against one another. Isn't this what Hitler tried to do, tried to unite the working class and the farming class, and narrow the divide that was placed between them? Look at the plainness and the boldness, yet the calm assurance, with which this plan is broached. Here's a quote. Our calculations reach out, especially into the country districts. There, we must necessarily arouse those interests and ambitions which we can always turn against the city, representing them to the cities as dreams and ambitions for independence on the part of the provinces. It is clear that the source of all this will be precisely the same, and that it will come from us. It will be necessary for us, before we have attained full power, to so arrange matters that, from time to time, the city shall come under the influence of opinion in the country districts, that is, of the majority prearranged by our agents. The preliminaries of the game are here set forth. To jockey city and farm against each other, that in the end the conspirators may use whichever proves the stronger in putting the plan over. In Russia, both schemes have been worked. The old regime, established in the cities, was persuaded to lay down power because it was made to believe that the peasants of Russia requested it. Then, when the Bolshevists seized power, they ruled the peasantry on the ground that the cities wanted it. The cities listened to the country, and now the country is listening to the cities. If you see any attempt made to divide city and farm into antagonistic camps, remember this paragraph from the 12th Protocol. Already the poison is working. Have you ever heard that prohibition was something which the backwoods districts forced upon the cities? Have you never heard that the high cost of living was due to extravagant profits of the farmer? Profits which he doesn't get? One big dent in this program of world control could be made if the citizen and farmer could learn each other's mind, not through self-appointed spokesmen, but directly from each other. City and farm are drifting apart because of misrepresentation of outsiders, and in the widening rift, the sinister shadow of the world program appears. Let the farmers look past the Gentile fronts in their villages or principal trading points, past them to the real controllers who are hidden. That's the end of this article. It was published September 4th, 1920, in the Dearborn Independent, of course. So I think this article, this subject matter, is really probably the most practically important for us to understand about how the Jew works and how they seize control and how they make us dependent. It's laid out very, very clearly that the Jews wanted to rip the farms away from our ancestors 100 years ago. And I have a personal story in my family of how that happened. On one side of my family, they were German farmers here in the Midwest and flyover country. My grandmother had 11 siblings, and they all worked on the farm. Well, my ancestors, my grandmother and her siblings ended up losing the farm because of eminent domain, which is where the government seizes property because of necessity of putting public workstations, sewer stations, that kind of thing, right? That's one way the Jews can strip away land from private citizens. They use eminent domain powers of the government. But this is probably the most practical, and this is probably the best avenue to try to reach people back then. The farms were our only source of independence. We didn't need Jew jobs. We didn't need wage slave jobs. We didn't need grocery stores. We didn't need any of this kind of crap because we had farms. We didn't need a job. We had a farm, take care of the, we raise crops, take care of livestock, and that way we always had a source of food, of survival, and we could make almost anything we needed. Of course, they had general stores back then where you could buy any supplies that you missed out on, but the farms were the source of white independence in America. As long as we had farms and we had plenty of family members and siblings to work them, we could all survive independently of the Jew finance world. The Jews recognized this, and of course, they targeted the farms for destruction. So look where we are 100 years removed. We live in a world where farming is looked down upon. Even if you happen to be in flyover country and you're born to parents that still have a farm and raise corn or soybeans or tobacco, something like that, you certainly don't want any part of that life, right? It's been ruined to the point where it's extremely risky. You have to borrow a lot of money. You have to buy a lot of expensive equipment. We're talking $300,000 combines that you have to use to collect the harvest at the end of the season, that you use to plant the seed in the beginning of the season. Farming in America today is extremely hard work. It's extremely risky. It's extremely burdensome financially because you have to borrow all this money to run the farm. And then on top of it, it's not very sexy or appealing. I'd say the work and risk is not worth the payout. And we have government programs and, of course, financial manipulations where they control the price of these they subsidize certain programs affect the prices of certain crops. But the farmer doesn't control the price of the crops that he sells. The international financial markets, like the Chicago Livestock Exchange, they control and manipulate all the prices. The Jew has rigged the system to where they profit on the sale of commodities, and they rig the price of commodities in their favor, and they do no work, yet make more of the profit than the farmer who does the majority of the work. This is essentially where we're at with it, and there's no doubt why the Jews destroyed farming, because they wanted us off our farms that we owned outright, and really, we're commanded to be farmers by biblical scripture. Yahweh commanded Adam to be a farmer and to till the ground. All the wealth comes from the ground. All the wealth in the world comes from the land, whether it's commodities or food or any other product. It all comes from the land. And of course, the Jew wanted to separate us from control of our own land so that we're wage slave goyim who don't own any property. We're paying the Jews rent. We're paying the Jews interest on the credit cards that we use. We're paying the Jews in the grocery stores that they own because we don't have any farms to feed ourselves. You see where I'm going with this. This was extremely important, and this is a big part of why the Jews were able to succeed to the extent that they have in America and in the world. They separated the white farmer from the farm, and by that, they totally control us. Now, just imagine for a second this scenario. If whites controlled all the sources of food, if whites controlled the food supply and controlled all the farms and had them paid for outright, and banded together and drew guns against government powers that tried to seize the farms. Think about it. We'd have the Jews over a barrel. We'd have the non-whites over a barrel. We would be in total control. We control the world's food supply. You know, the United States, I don't know about today, but 50, 60 years ago, 100 years ago, it was the industrious American farmer, American farms and agriculture, that fed the world. And the Jew was smart to dislodge us from control of the food supply and control of the farms. If we could ever get back there to where we controlled the food, we could essentially stop the Jewish power and stranglehold over our country and the other non-white races who seek to do us harm and exterminate us. Did you ever think about that? What if whites owned every little swath of land in this country? What if we owned all the farms? What if we owned all these small towns and kicked the Jews out and kicked the non-whites out? See, this is what we really could have done. And then notice in tandem with separating us from true financial power, the power of land ownership outright, not being indebted by mortgage loans. Not only that, but they encouraged us to get off the farms and go be a wage slave and then spend all of our paycheck and our money and our life's time on stupid, extravagant luxuries. So instead of going working a job and saving up money and living frugally to eventually buy a business and make even more money, we were encouraged to go work a wage slave job, and then take all the money and go buy big fancy cars, big fancy houses, and essentially consume it all, right? Spend it, blow it on luxury vacations, fancy nice cars that have car notes and mortgage loans, houses that have mortgage loans, bigger houses than we need, when really the key to financial independence is to have more assets than liabilities. Have more things that make you money than cost you money. And of course, today, it's totally opposite. People are upside down. They have negative self, negative worths. Total net worths are in the negative. They have way more debt than they have assets. They have way more things that take money out of their pocket than put money in their pocket. And there's no doubt that this is where the Jews want us. And they have us where they want us. There should be no denial of this. And we need to look at things and realize where they have us and try to change our ways. We could damage the Jews so much if we stop doing business with them. And that starts with the mortgage loans, the car loans, the credit cards, etc. And this is the way to independence. This is the way to being free and sovereign. Owe no man anything. The borrower is slave to the lender. We're commanded not to be borrowing people in our Christian scriptures. And yet, here we are. The Jews totally rule over us, and is it any coincidence that we're totally in debt and that the Jews rule over us? I mean, look at the United States government. They're $20 trillion in debt. Then add on top of it the fact that most Americans personally have a negative self-worth, have a negative savings rate, they have no assets, they can't come up with $400 or $1,000 for an emergency because they don't have any money, and they're one or two paychecks away from losing everything they have. The house is going to get repossessed as soon as they miss a payment. The car is going to get repossessed as soon as they miss a payment. The credit card debt keeps mounting and compounding every month if they don't pay down the balance. The list goes on. Is there any doubt that the Jews have us where they want us and that they molded us into this mindset? There's another point that I want to hit on here that's so important. And it's the fact that the Gentile mind is lazy. There's no doubt about this. There's no doubt about it. And if you do deny it, you're only fooling yourself. The Jews are right about many things. They have turned us into goyim, unfortunately. They've turned us into intellectually lazy, spiritually darkened, useless eaters, which is exactly how they see us. And unfortunately, more often than not, we confirm that stereotype to them by the stupid stuff we do in our lives. Okay, I've ranted for a good while. I've had commentary on this. I don't want to go any further because I don't want to make it too long. But let's move on to the next section. Okay, we're on to the second part here. This is entitled, Does Jewish Power Control the World Press? The purpose of this article is twofold. To set forth what the protocols have to say about the relation of the press to the world program, and to make an introduction to a study of Jewish influence on the press. The Jewish race has always been aware of the advantages to be derived from news. This was one of the factors in its control of European commerce from the earliest Christian times. To be informed beforehand, to know what was coming before the Gentiles among whom they lived knew it, was a special privilege of the Jews, made possible by the close communication in which widely separated Jewish groups kept themselves. From the very first, they were inveterate correspondents. They were inventors of the newsletter. This does not imply, however, that the Jews were the forerunners or even the sponsors of the modern press. It was no part of their purpose to distribute news among the people, but to keep it for themselves as a secret advantage. The political and economic and commercial news, which sped with really remarkable facility throughout Europe from Jewish community to Jewish community, was in reality the official budget by which each community informed all the others of what was transpiring as to war, trade currents, rising emergencies, or whatever the matter may have been. For centuries, the Jews were the best informed people on the continent, from their secret sources in courts and chancelleries, from privileged Jews who were placed in every position of vantage, the whole race was informed of the state of the world. Scouts were kept in motion everywhere. Far down in South America, before the British or the Dutch colonies in North America had hardly secured a foothold, there were Jews who served as outposts for European trade interests. The world was spied out in the interests of their race. Just as today, the entire planet is under the watchful eyes of Jewish agents, mostly Gentiles, it must be said, any hint of new gold discoveries. An interesting and historic illustration of the Jews' appreciation of news is to be found in the career of Nathan Rothschild. Rothschild had laid all his plans on the assumption that the Emperor Napoleon, then banished to Elba, was finally eliminated from European affairs. Napoleon unexpectedly returned, and in the 100 days, it seemed as if the Rothschild financial edifice might collapse. Feverishly, the financier aided both Prussia and England, and as the Battle of Waterloo approached, no one was more interested in the outcome than he. Rothschild was a man who shrank from the sight of blood. He was physically a coward, and any sign of violence unnerved him. But so intense was his interest in the battle on which his whole fortune seemed to depend, that he hastened to France, followed the British army, and when the battle began, he hid himself in some shot-proof nook near Hougemont, where he watched all day the ebb and flow of battle. Just before Napoleon ordered the last desperate charge, Rothschild had his mind made up. He said afterward that his exclamation at this point was, "The House of Rothschild has won the battle." He hurried from the field, galloped wildly to Brussels, communicating not a word of what he knew to the anxious people he met by the way. Hiring a carriage at an exorbitant price, he galloped away to Ostend. Here a fierce storm was raging on the ocean, and no sailor was willing to set out for England, about 20 miles away. Rothschild himself, always afraid of danger, forgot his fear in his visions of the stock market. He offered 500, 800, and at length 1,000 francs to the man who would take him across. But no one dared. Finally, one sailor proposed that if Rothschild would pay 2,000 francs into his wife's hands, he would attempt it. Half dead, the two men reached the English coast, but without rest, Rothschild ordered express post and hurried away to London. Whip and spur were not spared on that journey. There were no telegrams in those days, no swift communication. England was anxious. The rumors were bad. And on the morning of June 20th, 1815, when Nathan Rothschild appeared in his usual place at the Stock Exchange and leaned against the column, England knew nothing of what he knew. He was pale and broken. The sight of his face led the other financiers to believe that he had received bad news from the front. Then it was seen that he was quietly selling his securities. What? Rothschild unloading his securities? The market dropped disastrously. A very panic seized the financiers. The market was flooded with consols offered for sale, and all that was offered, Rothschild agents bought. So it went on, all day the 20th and all day the 21st. At the close of business the second day, Rothschild's heavy chests were crammed with securities. Then, in the evening, a courier galloped into London with the news that Wellington had won and Napoleon was a fugitive. But Nathan Rothschild had made $10 million, and the men he did business with had lost that much, all as an affair of news. There was a little incident in Washington during the war, a leak of news, it was called. The wise men of Wall Street sometimes whisper that even between 1914 to 1918, there were men of Rothschild's race who showed his same appreciation of news, with the same profitable results. And not only the men of Rothschild's race, but some of their Gentile fronts also. There were times during the war when no Gentile knew what was going on in certain countries. The Jewish leaders always knew. Some very interesting testimony can be presented on that point. Aside from its own interest, this Rothschild narrative fully illustrates the statement that while the Jews were very early news gatherers, they were not publicists. They used the news for their own benefit. They did not disseminate it. If it had depended on their influence, there would have been no public press at all. It was in France, which had no newspapers outside the capital, that the French Revolution was possible. There being no reliable exchange of news and opinion, the people were kept in ignorance. Paris itself did not know that the Bastille had fallen until the next day. Where there is no press, minorities easily gain control, as the Jewish Bolshevik Revolution in Russia clearly illustrates. One of the most dangerous developments of the time is public distrust of the press. If the day ever comes when swift, reliable, and authoritative communication with the entire people shall be necessary for public action in the interests of public safety, the nation may find itself sadly crippled unless a new confidence in the daily press can be built up. If for no other reason than that the free press is a safeguard against minority seizure of control, such laws as the zone laws or any restrictions on the freest and fullest communication between various parts of the country should absolutely be abolished. But the press, being in existence and being largely an Anglo-Saxon creation, it is a force not to be treated lightly, and that is the point where the world program and Jewish control come into contact with it. The protocols, which overlook nothing, propose a very definite plan with regard to the press. As in the multitude of other matters with which these remarkable documents deal, there are the two phases, what we have done and what we will do. As early as the second protocol, the press comes in for attention. It is significant that it makes its appearance in the same protocol in which the No Annexations program was announced 20 years before the World War, and the same protocol in which it is announced that Gentile rulers will be allowed to appear before the people for a short period. While Jewish influences were organizing themselves behind the seats of power, and in the same protocol where Darwinism, Marxism, and Nietzscheism are claimed among the most demoralizing doctrines which Jewish influence has disseminated. These are very curious statements, but not stranger than the actuality that has come to pass. The second protocol reads, "There is one great force in the hands of modern governments which creates thought movements among the people, that is, the press. The presumed role of the press is to indicate supposedly indispensable needs, to register popular complaints, and to create discontent. The triumph of free speech, or babbling, rests in the press. But governments are unable to profit by this power, and it has fallen into our hands. Through it, we have attained influence while remaining in the shadow. Thanks to it, we have amassed gold, though it has cost us torrents of blood and tears." In the same protocol, our press is spoken of as the agency through which are disseminated those theories of life which we have induced them, the Gentiles, to regard as the dictates of science. Reads like this, "To this end, we shall certainly endeavor to inspire blind confidence in these theories by means of our press." Then follows the claim made concerning the three most revolutionary theories in the physical, economic, and moral realms, namely Darwinism, Marxism, and Nietzscheism. In the third protocol, the claim is made that this control of the press is being used to break down respect for authority. Daring journalists and audacious pamphleteers make a daily attack upon the personnel of the administration. This abuse of authority is definitely preparing the downfall of all institutions, and everything will be overturned by blows coming from the infuriated populace. Again, in the seventh protocol, discussing the progress which the world program has already made, part played by the press is indicated. "We must force the Gentile governments to adopt measures which will promote our broadly conceived plan already approaching its triumphal goal, by bringing to bear the pressure of stimulated public opinion, which has in reality been organized by us, with the help of the so-called greater power of the press. With few exceptions not worth considering, it is already in our hands." Thus twice is the claim made to control of the press. "It has fallen into our hands," says the second protocol. "It is already in our hands," says the seventh. In the second protocol, the press is represented as furthering revolutionary physical, economic, and moral philosophies, while in the seventh, it is used to create the pressure of stimulated public opinion for the purpose of forcing Gentile governments to adopt measures which will promote our broadly conceived plan, already approaching its triumphal goal. A word of comment may be made here upon the claim of the second protocol that, thanks to the press, we have amassed gold, though it has cost us torrents of blood and tears. This is a statement which can be illustrated in many ways. Though it has cost us torrents of tears and blood, is an admission upon which the protocols throw light, a light which also shines upon the Jewish argument regarding responsibility for the recent war, namely, that Jewish world financial power could not have willed the war, seeing that the Jews suffered so heavily in Eastern Europe. The protocols frankly recognize the possibility of Jews suffering during the establishment of the world program, but it consoles them with the thought that they fall as soldiers for the good of Israel. The death of a Jew, we're told in the protocols, is more precious in the sight of God than the death of 1,000 seed of cattle, which is one of the delicate names applied to the Gentiles. The reference to the amassment of gold is very clear. It does not apply to ownership of publications and a share in their profits only, but also the use that may be made of them through the silence or outcry to promote international Jewish financiers' schemes. The Rothschilds bought editors as they bought legislators. It was a preliminary of nearly every scheme they floated to first fix the newspapers, either for silence or claque boosting. In matters of war and peace, in the removal of administrations whom their Jewish masters wished to be rid of, in the gradual building up of reputation and influence for rising men who had been chosen for work in the future. In these and like matters, the press very greatly aided the international cabal in attaining its end. All the details of the foregoing paragraph can be illustrated at length by instances which have occurred in the United States within the past 15 years. There was once a senator in the United States who, but that story illustrates another point also, and will be reserved until that point is reached in this series of discussion. The 12th Protocol, however, contains the entire plan of control of the press, reaching from the present time into the future when the Jewish world government shall be established. The reader is invited to read carefully and thoughtfully the deep and wide outreaching of this plan. Keep also in mind the boast that has been made for generations that no publication has handled the Jewish question in a manner distasteful to the Jewish powers has been allowed to live. What role is played at present by the press? It serves to inflame the passions of selfish partisanship which our interests require. It is shallow, lying, and unfair. The most people do not understand what end it serves. In that quotation, we have the same low estimate which was noted when we studied the estimate of human nature, which the protocols contain. Now, for the plan of press control, we separate the points for convenience. We shall handle the press in the following manner. 1. We shall saddle it and keep tight rein upon it. We shall do the same also with other printed matter. For of what use is it to rid ourselves of attacks in the press if we remain exposed to criticism through pamphlets in books? 2. Not one announcement will reach the people save under our supervision. We have attained this at the present time to the extent that all news is received through several agencies in which it is centralized from all parts of the world. A sidelight on the first sentence above may be had from the Jewish statement regarding the British declaration relating to Palestine. This declaration was sent from the Foreign Office to Lord Walter Rothschild, came perhaps as a surprise to large sections of the Jewish people, but to those who were active in Zionist circles, the declaration was no surprise. The wording of it came from the British Foreign Office, but the text had been revised in the Zionist offices in America as well as in England. British declaration was made in the form in which the Zionists desired. That's from page 85 and 86, Guide to Zionism by Jesse E. Samter, published by the Zionist Organization of America. 3. Literature and journalism are two most important educational forces, and consequently, our government will become the owner of most of the journals. If we permit 10 private journals, we shall organize 30 of our own, and so on. This must not be suspected by the public, for which reason all the journals published by us will be externally of the most contrary opinions and tendencies, thus evoking confidence in them and attracting our unsuspecting opponents, who will thus be caught in our trap and rendered harmless. This is most interesting in view of the defense now being made for so many Jewish journals. Look at the newspapers owned and controlled by the Jews, they say. See how they differ in policy. See how they disagree with each other. Certainly, externally, as Protocol 12 says, but the underlying unity is never hard to find. Besides, one way of discovering who are the people that have knowledge of the Jewish world problem, of whom can be convinced of it, or who will write about it, is just to start a paper which externally seems to be independent of the Jewish question. So deeply is this thought shared by even uneducated Jews that a rumor is today widespread in the United States that the reason for the present series of articles in the Dearborn Independent is the desire of its owner to forward the Jewish World Program. Unfortunately, this scheme of starting a fake opposition in order to discover where the real opposing force is not confined to the Jewish internationalists, although there is every indication that it was learned from them. This idea of a misrepresentative front for certain secret purposes is expressed at length, not only with reference to the press, but throughout the protocols and other relations. But in Protocol 12, it is fully developed with regard to the press, as the following quotations show. In order to force writers into such long productions that no one will read them, a tax on writing is proposed. On books less than 30 pages, a double tax. Small articles are most feared. Therefore, doubly tax the pamphlets of less than 30 pages. The longer articles, fewer will read. So the protocols argue, and the double tax will thus force writers into such long productions that they will be little read, especially as they will be very expensive. But that which we ourselves shall publish for directing the public mind will be cheap and widely read. The tax will discourage mere literary ambition, whereas the fear of punishment will make the writers subservient to us. Even if there should be those who may desire to write against us, no one will publish their writings. Think of how many American writers know this. Before accepting any work for printing, the publisher or printer must obtain permission from the authorities. Thus, we will know in advance what attacks are being prepared against us and shall be able to counteract them by coming out beforehand with explanations on the subject. That's largely the situation today. They do know in advance what is being done, and they do seek to disarm it beforehand. Here are the 3 degrees of Jewish journalism, which are not only stated in the protocols, but are observable in the everyday world of the present. The leading place will be held by organs of an official character. They will always stand guard over our interests, and consequently, their influence will be comparatively small. The second place will be held by semi-official organs whose aim it will be to attract the indifferent and lukewarm. In the third category, we shall place organs of apparent opposition. At least one will be extremely antagonistic. Our true opponents will mistake this seeming opposition as belonging to their own group, and thus will show us their cards. I beg you to notice that among those who attack us there will be organs founded by us, and they will attack exclusively those points which we plan to change or eliminate. All our papers will support most diverse opinions, aristocratic, Republican, even anarchist, so long, of course, as the Constitution lives. These fools who believe they are repeating the opinions expressed by their party newspapers will be repeating our opinions or those things which we wish them to think. By always discussing and contradicting our writings superficially and without touching upon their essence, our press will keep up a blank fire against the official newspapers, only to give us opportunity to express ourselves in greater detail than we could in our first declaration. This will be done when useful to us. These attacks will also convince the people of the full freedom of the press, and it will give our agents the opportunity of declaring that the papers opposing us are mere windbags, since they cannot find any real arguments to oppose our orders. Undoubtedly, that would be the case were all the papers controlled. In the case of the present series of articles, however, the tables appear to be turned. It is the Jewish press which has so signally failed to bring forward disproof either by fact or argument. When necessary, we shall promulgate ideas in the third section of our press as feelers, and then refute them vigorously in the semi-official papers. We shall overcome our opponents without fail, because they will not have organs of the press at their disposal. The pretext for suppressing a publication will be that it stirs up the public mind without basis of reason, a pretext which has already been urged time and again, but without the legal power to effect suppression, although without legal power, the Jewish interests in the United States have effected a pretty complete suppression of everything they do not desire. How far does Jewish influence control the newspapers of the United States? Insofar as the use of the word Jew is concerned, the press is almost completely dominated. The editor who uses it is certain to hear from it. He will be visited and told, contrary to everything the Jew is told, that the word Jew denotes a member of a religious denomination and not a member of a race, and that its use with reference to any person spoken of in public, prince, is as reprehensible as Baptist, Catholic, or Episcopalian were used. The Jew is always told by his leaders that regardless of religion or country of birth, he is a Jew, the member of a race by virtue of blood. Pages of this paper could be filled with the most authoritative Jewish statements on this point. But what the Jew is told by his leaders and what the Gentile editor is told by the Jewish committee are two different and antagonistic things. A Jewish paper may shriek to the skies that Professor so-and-so or Judge so-and-so or Senator so-and-so is a Jew, but the secular newspaper that should do that would be visited by an indignant committee bearing threats. A certain newspaper, as a mere matter of news, published an excerpt from one of the Dearborn Independent articles. Next day, a number of advertising accounts dropped for lack of copy. Inquiry developed the fact that the reticent advertisers were all Jewish firms, and the cause of their action was the really unimportant excerpt which the paper published. It developed also that the advertising agent who handled all the advertising for those Jewish firms was himself a Jew who also held an office in a Jewish secret society, which office was concerned exclusively with the control of newspapers in the matter of Jewish publicity. It was this man who dealt with the editor. A lame editorial retraction followed, which faintly praised the Jews. The advertising was returned to the paper, and it is just a question whether that editor was rightly handled or not. Certainly he has been made to feel the power, but the diplomacy of it was bad. The editor, along with hundreds of others, has only been given the proper background for estimating the Jewish power in its wider reaches. This is not to say that every editor should enter upon a campaign to expose the secret power. That's a matter for personal decision. Every editor, however, is so situated that he can see certain things, and he ought to see them, note them, and inwardly digest them. Jewish publicity in response to these articles is very easy to get in almost any newspaper. Some have fallen most lamentably for lying statements. Others have opened their columns to propaganda sent out from Jewish sources. That is all very well. But the Gentile interest in the question has been largely ignored, even in cases where the editors are awake to the whole question. This, too, affords a vantage from which the average editor can view what is transpiring in this country. If a list of the Jewish owners, bondholders, and other interests in our newspapers should be published, the list would be impressive, but it would not account for the widespread control of the press as observed in this country. Indeed, it would be unfair in such a connection as this to list some of the Jewish-owned newspapers of the United States because their owners are fair and public-spirited servants of the people. Actual ownership does not often account for much in a newspaper. Ownership in the newspaper business is not always synonymous with control. If you wish to know the control of the newspaper, look to its attorney and the interests he serves. Look to the social connections of its chief editors. Look to the advertising agents who handle the bulk of Jewish advertising. Then look to the matter of the paper's partisanship or independence in politics. Newspaper control of the press by the Jews is not a matter of money. It's a matter of keeping certain things out of the public mind and putting certain things into it. One absolute condition insisted upon with the daily press is that it shall not identify the Jew, mention him, or in any but the most favorable way call the public's attention to his existence. The first plea for this is based on fairness, on the false statement that a Jew is not a Jew but a church member. This is the same statement which Jewish agents in the United States government have used for years to prevent the U.S. government from listing the Jews in any racial statistics. It is in direct contradiction to what the Jews themselves are told.
a flabby fairness, a sloppy broad-mindedness, a cry of religious prejudice is the first plea. The second is a sudden cessation of Jewish patronage. The third is withdrawal of patronage by every Gentile concern that is under the grip of Jewish financiers. It is a mere matter of brutal bludgeoning. And the fourth act, in a community thoroughly blinded to the Jewish question, is the collapse of the offending publication. Read the Jewish Encyclopedia for a list of some of the papers which dared open up the question and ceased. One old Baron Moses Montefiore said at Krakow, "What are you prating about? As long as we do not have the press of the whole world in our hands, everything you may do is vain. We must control or influence the papers of the whole world in order to blind and deceive the people." He knew what he was saying. By blinding the people, he only meant that they should not see the Jew, and by deceiving them, he only meant that the people should think certain world movements meant one thing when they really meant another. The people may be told what happens. They may not be told what was behind it. The people do not yet know why certain occurrences have affected their whole lives, should have occurred at all. But the why of it is very definitely known in certain circles whose news service never sees print, and sometimes not even writing. Statistics as to the space given the Jews by newspapers concerning things they want to get into print would also be an eye-opener. A minority nation, they get more publicity than any 10 of the important minor nations of Europe, of the kind of publicity they want. The number of Jewish contributors to the press of the United States makes another interesting statistical bit. It would be sheer prejudice to make objectionable mention of many Jewish journalists and writers, and they come within the scope of this study only as they have shown themselves to be the watchful agents and active servants of the system. This is what many of them are. Not the ambitious young Jewish reporter who runs around the streets gathering news, perhaps, but the journalist at the seat of the news and at the neck of those two or three important international runways through which the news of the world flows. The whole matter, as far as extent of control is concerned, could be visualized on a map of the United States by means of colored pins showing the number of Jewish-owned, provably Jewish-controlled newspapers and the number of Jewish writers who are directing the majority thought of the various sections of the country. The Jewish journalist who panders to unrest, whose literary ambition is to maintain a ferment in his readers, whose humor is sordid and whose philosophy is one of negation, as well as the Jewish novelist who extols his or her own people even while the story sows subtle seeds of disruption in Gentile social or economic life, must be listed as the agents of that world program which would break down society through the agency of ideas. And it's very striking how many there are, and how skillfully they conceal their propaganda in their work. Here and there in the U.S., it's now becoming possible to print the word Jew in the headlines of an article, and tell the Jewish committee, which calls the next day, that this is yet a free country. Quietly, a number of newspapers have tested the strength of this assumed control in their communities, and have discounted it. There is no reason for fear on the part of the editor who has his facts. But the editor who backs down will more and more feel the pressure upon him. The man who courageously and fairly holds his ground will soon learn another thing that is not so generally known, namely, that with all the brilliance there is a lot of bluff, and that the chain of control, once broken, is felt throughout the whole system as a blow. There is nothing that the international Jew fears so much as the truth, or any hint of the truth about himself or his plans, and, after all, the rock of refuge and defense, the foundation of endurance for Jew or Gentile, must be the truth. Published September 11th, 1920. So there you have it. You thought Jew-controlled media was a problem today? How about 100 years ago? It was a problem even then. What's the point of controlling the world press? Very simply, to control the thoughts, attitudes, emotions, and worldview of the Gentiles. If you want to rule over somebody, you have to dumb them down and control what they think about you. It's that simple. That's why the Jews control the news media. I hope you enjoyed. Until next time, take care. Praise Christ. Bye-bye.
tuned in to Radio Aaron.